The meeting is opened. I wish to welcome the delegation from Business Unit South Africa led by the CEO and thank you for accepting our invitation. We really appreciate it. It is also a privilege to us to have you in front of us because we know that you are the voice of the business. When you speak in Netlek, we know that you are not speaking as scattered, you are speaking for all businesses in South Africa. And we also value your participation in Netlek. So there are certain areas of focus that we have asked you to present in front of us. As a portfolio committee on labor, in terms of our core mandate in doing oversight, we are not really entrusted with creation of jobs. There is a public works committee, but you can't be in labor. You can't talk about workers or can't talk about labor and not talk about workers. We can't be in a position to ensure that workers have decent jobs if we don't know about the creation of jobs. So we will give it to Busa. In fact, let me introduce the members. There are members, as I've said before we open the meeting, that some members are writing and some are busy in other committees. So we have four inside here, five by myself. You know that we are composed of different parties, so mainly it's DA and ANC, those that are in. They can introduce themselves. Olis, you can start, please, Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. Apologies, I was caught in a traffic jam on the N2. Jan Olis from the Democratic Line. Thank you.
Eric Nyagamba from the ANC. George Pienamo from the Democratic Line. Thank you.
Apologies for making a mistake of saying it's ANC and DA. I thought Honorable Maitisha has crossed over again. But my apologies, it's still coming. Over to you. Mr. CEO.
Thank you for the opportunity to come this morning and be able to exchange and share some thoughts that you have on the issues that you've requested us to deal with, and also to just give you a sense of some perspectives on the thinking from the business side and the sort of initiatives and programs that we have been engaged in, especially in response to the State of the Nation address that we also take as a very critical milestone for us in business in determining and setting up our own agenda in relation to our engagement with other social partners, including labor, community, and government. With me this morning is a team with my deputy, the deputy CEO of BUSA, Professor Raymond Parsons, and then next to me is Ms. Bev Jack, who is also one of the key players in one of our committees and dealing with the issue of decent work in particular, which with an area that she will touch on later. And then on the other side, we've got Kunrad Bezudenot, who heads our parliamentary office, which is within a walking distance from this office, where at some point we would like to have the privilege of hosting you, Comrade Chair, and members of the committee to just have a discussion in a free-flowing way with the BUSA office bearers, including the President and the Vice President. And next to Kunrad is Lee, who is responsible for, she's our communications and information officer in Parliament and publishes or prepares a newsletter that circulates to business every week, informing the business community throughout the country on what is happening in Parliament, so that we keep the business community in terms of issues that are in Parliament in different portfolio committees, especially those that have got relevance to business. Chair, I thought I would start by just quickly introducing who we are as BUSA, especially because this morning I just got correspondence as I landed here in Cape Town from my office that there is a labor union which have just been registered, which is called BUSA, standing for Basebenzi Union of South Africa, also with the acronym BUSA. So we're not representing Basebenzi Union of South Africa, we are presenting today Business Unity South Africa, which is a confederation of organized business in the country representing national chambers of commerce and industry, professional associations, corporate associations, and unisectoral organizations, as well as a number of corporates that are direct members through a board of trustees. We are the principal representative of business in South Africa, representing the views of the South African business community in a number of national structures and bodies, both statutory and non-statutory bodies. We also represent business interests in the National Economic Development and Labour Chamber or Council, at that is NEDLEC. Our areas of focus are in the areas of macroeconomic and high-level national issues that are cross-cutting across sectors and affecting doing business in the country, but also at international level, because we also focus on positioning South Africa as an investment destination of choice to investors globally, but also seek market opportunities for South African companies of all sizes, whether in the region, in the continent, but also in other continents. And for that reason, we are the South African representative body in the IOE, which is the International Organization of Employers, in the Pan-African Employers Confederation in Africa, and the Southern African Development Communities Employers Group, SEG, which we are currently chairing, as well as the ILO, we represent the South African business and within the different structures of the AU where there's engagement with business. We also have various business councils that we have set up with different countries coming from state visits by the presidents, wherein we often participate and organize business participation whenever the president goes, invites business to accompany him on state visits. In response, Chair, to the issues that you've asked us to speak on this morning, I think I would like to just start off by responding to the issue of our view and what business is doing in responding to the issue of poverty. We are very cognizant of the challenge of poverty in our country, especially because we participated in a number of key reports that have been produced reviewing progress made by our country since 1994. The first one, which was done by the Harvard professors, called the Harvard Review, initiated by National Treasury, and the second one, which was the OECD Economic Review of South Africa, which was part of the review by OECD of South African various areas of progress made since 1994. What is common in the findings of those two reports, but also in other reports, including the report done by the presidency looking at progress we've made since 1994, I think three things that are highlighted in every report looking at South Africa's progress since 1994. The three issues that continue to be highlighted is that despite whatever progress we've been able to achieve, poverty still remains rife, inequality still remains very strongly visible in our society, and thirdly, that unemployment remains unacceptably high. So as business, we have been engaging on how do we respond as a business community to help address these areas. So our view is that we're starting off from that recognition on some of the areas where we have made progress as a country, that indeed there are areas where we can celebrate visible progress we've made, but definitely we still have these challenges that we need to respond to. Therefore, the issue of halving unemployment and eradicating poverty is an issue that remains in the radar screen of all our policy engagement and what we do as business. Our view is that strong focus on achieving higher economic growth is needed in order to create economic opportunities for poor households in the form of job creation and empowerment. I think clearly what we are saying here is that we strongly believe that one of the major instruments that we can utilize to undo poverty is to create opportunities where people can either become entrepreneurs in their own right, seize those opportunities, or where South Africans will get an opportunity to have a job. And therefore, the issue of job creation, we think it's very instrumental to addressing poverty. We have identified what we have called 9 pillars of anti-poverty as we see it as our response. The first one being the issue of economic growth. Chair, this is always a debate, and especially because I think it's also raised by experiences where we have seen at certain points in history where the economy grew at particular points and people then saying, but business, you have enjoyed economic growth during this phase, where are the jobs? Indeed, it is a reality that there are times in history, both from our own experiences but elsewhere, where the economy can grow depending on what drives that economic growth, not be able to create the right levels of jobs. However, from the experience that we had before the global economic crisis, when our economy started growing on average, reaching about 5% per annum, we saw at that point that we were able to reach a point where this economy started creating 500,000 jobs per annum. It is for that reason, for instance, when this new economic growth path was released by government, we welcomed it, even the target of 5 million jobs in 10 years, because we believe it is achievable, because we've seen it happening when the economy grew at 5%, we're able to achieve 500,000 jobs. And therefore, we strongly want to put before honorable members that economic growth is very key to addressing poverty, because it will create jobs. And then enhanced competition in our country or in our economy is necessary for improving efficiency and growth. You will follow, Chair, that you have supported and worked very closely with the Competition Commission, because we do believe that there's much that needs to be done to ensure that you've got competitive business in the country and this competition, because it does allow efficiency and growth and brings in technology. We welcome the initiative yesterday by the DTI, for instance, when it announced this 20 billion tax incentive, because we believe it will help this economy to be competitive and attract further investment. One of the issues we've always raised in the past few years in our engagement with both the presidency but also with different departments and ministries is the need for us as a country to develop a regulatory impact assessment, which we implement and apply each time there's a new legislation and regulation, because we have found that there are times when well-intended regulation and legislation have had unintended consequences. Some legislation which would have worked and did work perfectly well with big business have had huge negative impact, for instance, on SMEs and new enterprises. So we continue to say, for us to progress, we need to implement a regulatory mechanism which will help us whenever we implement new legislation. BBB opportunities must be leveraged to grow SMEs and reduce poverty. We strongly hold the view that we need to continue to ensure that we remove obstacles to the implementation of black economic empowerment, because we believe that the fundamentals that are there in the Act, and if they are all applied by all of us, they do offer an opportunity for addressing poverty and allowing new enterprises to grow. The issues of SME growth is one of the other issues that we are working with some of our members, especially those that represent small, medium, especially emerging entrepreneurs, some of which operate in rural areas and townships. That's why within our membership we've got organizations such as SACI, such as NAFCOC, FABCOS, and others, so that we can engage on the issues. And then skills development, we continue to support the implementation of skills development initiatives, because one other issue that keeps the majority of our people outside the mainstream activities of our economy is lack of skills. We strongly believe that capacitating and skilling our nation is a vital component of dealing with poverty and creating jobs. The issue of local level service delivery is very key in our view, and that is why we are also engaging with government, looking at how business partners with local government, with municipalities, especially we have seen in some of the municipalities and local government the challenges in terms of lack of resources and particularly of skills in certain areas that are required at the level of delivery. simple piece, public-private partnerships, often is seen as just an acronym that gets used and that we use very often and very easily. But from experiences and from our interaction, committee chair, members of the committee, in engaging with many other countries, we have found that the more you are able to bridge the gap between government and other social partners, especially with business, where business and government work together side by side and find ways of leveraging capacities and technologies and resources that exist on either party, those countries have been able to do more and progress more. It is for that reason that we continue as BUSA to advocate and push for more private-public partnership, whether it's in infrastructure development, whether it's in service delivery, in various areas of government, in health delivery. We strongly believe that we can do more in that area to address poverty. Some of the strategic interventions in which we will be involved in, we believe will promote poverty reduction over the coming months, will include programs on rural development and food security, SME support, which I referred to earlier on, and enhancing projects in the financial services sector. We've had a meeting with the Minister of Rural Development, who briefed us on what his department is looking at in terms of rural development. He presented challenges to business in terms of us looking at areas of partnering with government in dealing with the issue of rural development. We strongly are very geared towards working with government because we know, Chair, that part of the challenge, for instance, we debate often the issue of labor costs in this country, and others arguing that it's not high, it's low. But when we compare ourselves with other countries, we clearly always come to the point that our labor costs are high. But we know that part of the reason why our labor costs are high is that our special development in this country has continued to be the same pre-94 special development, where workers don't live near the places where they work. And one of the costs that ultimately workers have to bear is transport costs to go to work. And that transport cost gets pushed to business to carry. So part of reducing the cost of doing business, we believe, ultimately will engage us in looking at issues of rural development, looking at anew into special development, and how far and where employees are located. I'm going to pause here, and my colleague, Professor Parsons, will continue and just give a rundown on the job rich growth, as we have said that we subscribe to economic growth as a key pillar for addressing poverty, but he will talk to the issue of what we are doing this year following the State of the Nation address, particularly in searching for growth which is inclusive and creating opportunities for everyone.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Just to perhaps supplement what the BUSA CEO has said in regard to job-rich growth, this is something that BUSA has been very strongly involved in, especially recently, in the light of the statement made by government just prior to the so-called mini-budget, which gave an indication of how the government saw the path towards a job-rich growth path. Prior to that, we had already begun to do some research on what could be our contribution, not only to the debate, but also to the decisions and to the implementation of such decisions that still have to be taken in regard to reaching that growth path. And just to add to what was said earlier, you will know that from the mini-budget, that the projections by the National Treasury are that by 2014, we can expect to grow at roughly just over 4% in GDP. Yet, as has also been indicated, that is simply not good enough. Even if you could maximize the number of jobs that are created at any particular growth rate. And I'm reminded of the experience I had a year or two ago, if I could share that with you, when a Chinese economist came to visit me to speak about South Africa. But before I could start to talk about South Africa, he said, "Oh, Professor Parsons, I have to say this to you before we start." He said, "You know, where I've come from, we have a runaway train. I mean, we're growing at 10-11%. It's causing huge challenges, huge problems. What are we going to do?" I said, "Give me that problem. I would love the problem of a 10-11% growth rate, and then we'll manage that. It's a much bigger challenge to take a 2-3% growth rate and try and get it up." So I think both in the mini budget and in the initial statement about a job-rich growth path, we certainly, I think, we need to engage in a way that will lift the constraints on our economy so that we can grow more rapidly, we can create more jobs, that we are in a better and a stronger position to deal with poverty and with inequalities. Now, we're working on a document at the moment, which we hope will see the light of day shortly, but there are a number of choices that are beginning to emerge, which I'll just share with you very briefly in this document, which bears on the issue of growth and employment. I think one point of departure is that we've recognized that, in fact, we do have a much greater potential for higher growth. We're not trying to reach for the stars when we say that we should be able to grow at 5-6%. But there will be certain constraints that have to be addressed. So that's the one point of departure. The second is that we also recognize that it has to be a collaborative effort. We need to build some consensual stability around the strategies that will emerge, and that's why it has been the declared intention of government to produce a more substantial document shortly, which will be the basis for engagement with the social partners in order to see how we can best collaborate in order to get higher growth and more jobs. The third point is the issue of public sector delivery, which we think is very important, and we think that the concept of improving delivery of social services that only the government can deliver in those instances, that there are more creative ways of being able to address that. The third point of departure is the issue of the educational system, where we will be coming up with some recommendations as to how to gear our whole educational and training system more effectively to the needs of our economy and thus be able to ensure that they contribute towards job creation, so that we hope that within a certain period, and we like the National Planning Commission are looking at a 2025 vision, that we could make a lot more progress as business in closing the skills gap. Then we also, and I think our CEO has referred to that, the issue of the implementation of IPAP, our whole industrial action program, of which we had quite an important announcement yesterday, which we've supported and encouraged the Department of Trade and Industry to move down that road to improve the investment climate and to ensure that embedded in that process is the potential for greater job creation on the one end, and also to ensure that we are more globally competitive on the other. The issue of youth unemployment is also going to feature in our document. Are there more creative ways to absorb youth unemployment than the ways we are setting about it now? So that will be another area that we will address. But I think just to perhaps supplement what the BUSA CEO has said, to say that we hope in terms of more specific recommendations other than what we will be presenting today as either work done or work in progress, we'll be able to capture some new recommendations in our own inclusive job reach document, which should be available in the next couple of weeks. Thank you, Chair.
Madam Chair, briefly to give some background in terms of the WHSSA and the NEDLAC process with regards to decent work. To understand that the concept of decent work has been a discussion item for over a decade as far as the ILO is concerned. And whilst we as a country signed off our decent work program just a couple of weeks ago at the end of September, there has been a lot of work in progress in terms of implementing and operationalizing a number of the key outcomes, so that certainly it's not simply a paper strategy, but work in progress. Really, just to take through some background in terms of the Decent Work Country Program, it's been a process that we have been engaging at NEDLAC. We are very fortunate to have the ILO leading us in terms of this particular process. We have a steering committee, which is the tripartite and plus. We believe that we are probably one of the few countries in the world that has the community actively involved with us in working on this program. And I think specifically with our strategy currently in developing activities and seeing initiatives at the rural areas, this becomes critical that the community is involved with us. At NEDLAC, as we discussed, we have signed off the base document and we have developed a decent work country program matrix. As a parallel process, at sector level, at industry sector, we have been running a decent work sector program. Again, with the ILO support and engagement, we believe we're probably one of the first in the world. They are researching us at this particular point because we wanted to ensure that the strategy could be applied at sector level. And we also wanted to ensure that we started to initiate some of these activities and accelerate some of the development and the points of pain that we feel in our country at this particular point. The Minister launched the Decent Work Country Program on the 29th of September, and a memorandum of understanding was signed by all parties. The Decent Work Country Program and Decent Work resides on four pillars and nine outcomes. The four pillars that we have, which are international, is to strengthen the fundamental principles and the rights at work, to promote employment creation, to strengthen and broaden social protection coverage, and to strengthen tripartism between labour, government, and business, and as we said, we've included the community, and to ensure that we strengthen and deepen our social dialogue. We did hand out to the honourable members, committee members, to yourself, Madam Chair, our industry trade journal, which has an article on achieving decent work in South Africa, and one will see from the article that it actually talks to addressing the operationalising of a number of the nine outcomes that we are addressing in terms of the country programme. The first outcome is to update our international labour standards to make sure that the conventions that are applicable are ratified, that we are complying with them, and that we report on them. And I think we identified that the reporting on a number of the initiatives that are taken in our country are not always adequately communicated, and we felt this was an area which we would be able to address. Our second outcome talks to the Labour Administration in terms of applying up-to-date labour legislation and providing effective services. Our CEO actually spoke to the critical need to encourage and strengthen public-private partnerships, and we're already seeing at operational level, particularly with the challenge of unemployed youth, of getting private and public employment services to work together. We've been on a number of study tours where we've seen global best practice, and we have started to initiate a number of these elements jointly at different sector levels. Our third outcome addresses the accessing by women and men, and particularly youth and people with disabilities, into productive and decent employment through job growth. And Madam Chair alluded to the fact that today in Labour, this discussion is not solely about job growth and job creation, but in fact 17 of the 44 indicators that we are addressing in decent work do talk to the need to create better access to employment for our people in South Africa. Outcome 4 addresses sustainable and competitive enterprises, including the development and sustainability of cooperatives to create productive and decent jobs, and again, looking at our women, high unemployment within our youth and people with disabilities. The chairperson has already talked, the CEO has already addressed the critical need for skills development, which underpins many of the initiatives that we have to ensure that we increase employability, not just the currency of skills to access the work market, but to ensure that our people have currency of skills throughout their lifetime in employment. We need to ensure that more people have access to improved and more gender equitable social benefits and health benefits. Workers and enterprises benefit from improved safety and healthy conditions of work. A critical element is that the world of work responds effectively to the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And our ninth outcome is to strengthen labour market institutes and capacitate our social partners to contribute to effective social dialogue and sound industrial relations. Moving forward, following the signing of the document and the finalising of our matrix, Business Unity South Africa, within our task team, have actually identified what we believe are our 10 priority areas in terms of moving forward, and we will assume that we will be tabling these at NEDLAC in the short term. The 10 that we have, the first one, labour market inspection systems in the public and private sector are strengthened, and we certainly wish to work in partnership, in collaboration and cooperation with our public partners to ensure through collaboration and cooperation that this becomes an advisory service as well as an inspectorate service. That the capacity of government and social partners is promoted in terms of employment equity and that this is strengthened at the workplace. The macroeconomic policy is strengthened to support employment and the decent work outcomes. To strengthen the national capacity to analyse and access data on decent work following locally relevant indicators. And this is where our work that we have commenced in terms of proof of concept at sector level so that we have a roll-down and a roll-up approach in terms of gathering data so that we can actually effectively measure what is happening in terms of our programme. Support for a coherent and enabling policy environment for the promotion of sustainable enterprises. Improved enterprise-level productivity and competitiveness through relevant skills programs. And obviously the measurement of productivity, we've been working very closely to ensure that this is measured equally and effectively across the sectors. Support for a new and more inclusive mandatory social security system. Policy and research support for the establishment of a national health insurance policy, capacity of trade unions and employer organisations to develop, secure finance and to implement HIV/AIDS workplace policies and programmes so that these are strengthened. And finally, our 10th imperative is the capacity of social partners is engaged more effectively to ensure that social dialogue is strengthened.
Thank you, Business South Africa, for detailed information on the issues that we have asked you to focus on. Members of Parliament, it's your time to ask clarities, comments or questions Honorable Nyakemba.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And also I think we need to welcome the presentation by the Federation of Business. I regard Musa like my comrades compare Musa with the Congress of South African Trade Unions. I can't think of another federation. That's what I said. I think that's a few issues for me, Chair. On skilling the nation, when the CEO said something in relation to this in his presentation, what came to mind to me is the delay of training scheme that was put in place by the Department of Labor and IDC, in particular when there was economic meltdown. But the reports that we're receiving, because the process that was supposed to be followed was through the CCMA, but most businesses were not following, didn't take advantage of that program that was put in place. I just want your comment on that. I mean, what was your observation? Because in reality, the reports that we're receiving, even when CCMA came to us as the Portfolio Committee, we counted a number of things. When we asked them about that, how many companies that are coming forward, only find that companies are not coming forward. What could be the reason when government put something in place to deal in particular with the issue of skilling workers? I think that's one point, Madam Chair. The second point is in relation to inequalities. What I understand that you were requested to speak to decent work agenda, the state of the national address. But I think it's important for you also to reflect on Employment Equity Commission reports, annual reports, which, in my view, paint a bad picture, in particular to the private sector. We have seen even this year when the chairperson of the Employment Equity Commission presented the report. In a way, she couldn't believe that this is happening. So I'm raising this because you did speak to this issue and, in your presentation. The last issue from me, Madam Chair, is in relation to labor costs. What is good is that what we normally hear is that the labor legislation needs to be reviewed. They need to be reviewed. As if workers do have, in fact, as if these legislations didn't come as a result of a tripartite dialogue where government, labor, and business engaged. And I was saying to the Deputy CEO before we start the meeting that he was one of the delegation at NADLEC when the labor legislation, in particular the labor legislation, was put in place. So I think you raise certain issues as to your thinking as business is that the why, in fact, why do you say the Aleppo cost is because of a number of things. You made an example of transport. Now, what is it that is in mind in you in addressing that? I agree with you that the issue of transport is something that needs to be attended to. And I also believe that business can play an important role in trying to look at what means of transport that are supposed to be put in place. Because transport is not only public transport alone, there are private transport. What is it that you think you can do in relation to that? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Honorable Nyakemba. Honorable Boy Mani. Boy Namo.
Thank you, Jefferson. Thank you. I want to thank Busa also for a very clear presentation. I've got questions for my questions are to the first presenter. Government is not really the creator of jobs, but its responsibility is to create conditions that are optimum for business investment and thereby creating jobs. Now, it is often said that our economic growth, for instance, does not translate into job creation. Now, my question here is, what is it that should be done in order to address this challenge, to ensure that as the economy grows, it reflects into job creation? We see people getting jobs. And Busa has alluded to the fact that it actually creates 500,000 jobs per annum. Are these permanent or casual jobs? If mixed, how many jobs are permanent? There is also a mention here of shortage of skills. And to me, this is just a broad phenomenon. Has Busa done a skills audit in this country in order to find out exactly what skills are lacking in South Africa and come up with a program to address and overcome this challenge? Now, to Professor Pazin, a radical re-engineering of the educational system, to me this seems like a mere talk show, for it has been an ongoing rhetoric since 1994. But if you look at our public schools, they continue to deteriorate in terms of learning and teaching facilities, and the outcomes are spiraling downwards every year. Our results are predictable. I can even tell you, even this year, we're not hoping to get better results. How can South Africa close the skills gap by 50%, as it has been mentioned in the presentation, if the majority of learners in this country are still attending schools that are dysfunctional? I believe that if this country needs to address inequality challenges, then it must mercilessly turn the educational system around. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable. Honorable Olive.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm by no means a labor expert, but I do understand how the economy roughly works. Sometimes somebody has to ask the difficult, awkward questions that often in South Africa we don't like to deal with. So if you'll forgive me, I'm going to ask one or two awkward questions, and it's not directed personally at Busa, it's directed at the environment that labor, business, and government operates in. What I want to do is liken the relationship that's been developing in South Africa between business, labor, and government as becoming somewhat cozy. And I think that we have a danger of developing a Stockholm syndrome, where we all so love each other and work together, and NEDLAC's wonderful, and we cooperate, and we do. We cooperate very well together. NEDLAC is a landmark institution, and worldwide we're known as being a country that gets the partners together, and we call them social partners, and we have tea, and we discuss, and we argue about labor laws and so on. But I wonder if it's not becoming too cozy. And the thing that made me think about that was that it was left this year to the finance minister to actually say that the increases in salaries were way above inflation and that it was making our labor very expensive. And there's a simple equation there for the man in the street like me who isn't a labor lawyer or an economist. The simple equation is this. The more expensive you make it to employ somebody, the fewer people you can employ. It's quite a simple equation. Now I want to ask some specific questions in that environment because I'm quite concerned. The Decent Work Country program is very important because it talks to basic human needs. But when you look at that program, you can break those needs into two things. You can break them into things which deal with your safety, your occupational health, the things that are in your work environment, which obviously are essential, need to be there. You can't send somebody to work without the proper gear. And we've been to factories where people don't get the proper gear, and we're quite upset about that. But it also speaks about other things. It talks about a living wage. It talks about all sorts of other things. Family security, I see, is one of the points in that APSO document that you had there. All of those things cost money. And I think another danger we have in South Africa is that the large unions are working very hard for their members. But the more they push up the cost of doing business, the more the unemployed are going to stay unemployed. And those unemployed have been the government, two successive governments, I think, have failed the education system, or the education system of two governments has failed the unemployed. Black, colored, and Indian people in South Africa have been dumped by a very poor education system times two. And perhaps now, a lot of white people are starting to suffer in the current education system of the public schools as well. I'm worried about that. And my question really is a simple one. What is BUSA, together with your other business organizations that are independent? We've got Business Leadership South Africa, we've got smaller ones like APSA, and there are quite a number of organizations like yourselves, you being probably the biggest in the country. What are you doing to hold the line, to point the finger when it's necessary, to not be as cozy to government and labor and everybody else as what it seems to be in South Africa, to ask the question, do we not need to review some labor laws? Are there not some demands that are unrealistic that we need to point out and not leave it to the finance minister to have to point out? I disagree with your CEO that 5 million jobs are fairly easy to attain. I think it's incredibly difficult to create 5 million new jobs. And the talk so far has been theoretical. Practically, how are we going to create 5 million new jobs if we all, you know, behave nicely and have tea and all that? We've got to have practical steps, and I'm wondering what steps are going to be put into place. Yes, government is coming up with a document, so I'm prejudging it a little bit. I haven't seen that document. But what really is government's role, and how strong is BUSA pointing out to government where their shortcomings are and what they need to do about this in the education system, in the job creation arena? Because I agree with my colleague over there, government doesn't create jobs, but government certainly creates the environment in which jobs can be created. And if we think we can tax the taxpayers more to create bigger public works programs to create those 5 million jobs, I think we're sucking eggs. You cannot take tax money, enough tax money, out of the taxpayers and employ people in the public service to get 5 million jobs. It's not going to happen. So the only way we can do it is by making business more productive, by encouraging small business to grow into medium-sized business, to encourage school kids to come out of school and start a little business. If they can't start it in the garage because dad doesn't have a garage, maybe they'll have to find a space. Maybe organizations like BUSA can help find little spaces where kids coming out of school that have got a bit of entrepreneurial ability and some skill can start a little business. I don't know. But I think that we're starting to get very cozy in South Africa, and we don't want to point the fingers when they need to get pointed. can I just get some indication from Busa, are you pointing the fingers? Are you prepared to go onto the mat and say, you know, actually, education department, you're not doing your job properly, and this is what we think you should do to change it. Union, you're not doing your job properly, or whoever it is. Political parties, you're not doing your job properly. I'd like to see a little bit more loud noise coming from the corner of business, and perhaps you can comment on the things you think we can do practically to create those 5 million jobs, because I think we're going to have a headache in 5 years' time. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Matisse.
Thank you, Chair. Just clarity. On the rather regarding the five pillars of Busa's direction, number five. Now, as articulated by that, I just want to look at the issue of evaluation. Okay. How does Busa assess or follow its affiliate in ensuring that proper work in line with the laws in the country, including the Labor Relations Act, is implemented? Because you may talk of, you know, the creation of jobs, etc., etc., but you find that those which fall under you don't really follow that. And this, I must say, there are quite many in the country, and I suppose you know that. But to simply say that this is the direction, this is what we believe in, etc., etc., does not really ensure the implementation of FAME. If you could say something, you know, about that. Secondly, yes, we talk about the non-employment in South Africa, so the unemployment, we talk about lack of jobs, etc., etc. But then there's a growth in respect of casual labor. Very many people are working in the country, and one will sit here and report that more than 50%. But these are people who come from outside of the country. And their work grows. But if you talk about the removal of, or contribute in the removal of poverty in the country, you obviously have got to talk about that as well, casualization labor in the country. And even those who are employed, they themselves, who are casual laborers, are not safe. What do you then say? Have you looked into that? The third area, point number four and six, when we talk about job-rich growth, number four and number six refer to skills development of at least 50%. Now, an indication is not given of the area where the unskilled are picked up. Just say skills development. Where do you get these unskilled people? Because you may say that we're busy killing people. From where? I think we need to talk about that. But to further say, once those skills are put in place, and like I'm saying, we don't know where, but then you can proceed to, you know, explain that. How do we do a number of things, including making sure that, yes, those who have been skilled are employed, and to further say, are these people given skills while they are working? Because people may be working without proper skills while they are working. Or do you ensure that as you ensure that these particular skills are developed, people who are, you know, collected from outside of the work employment, to ensure that, yes, those skills are, you know, effective? Because, yes, people may be skilled from wherever, but then, yes, and I think these people are very many. Last week, for example, through your chair, there are a number of people who came to me to say We've been trained, we've gone on through this kind of thing, but they're just nowhere. They've been there for 3, 4, 5 years without any work altogether. Now, the next last point, Chair. In 1998, unemployment rate in the country was almost 40%. And I remember President Mandela then brought business, labor, and government together to say, let's look into how we can resolve this thing. And the country created the Labor Job Creation Trust, which in 2000 was able to collect 89 million rand. And I know that 39,000 jobs have been created. But then I know that business has not contributed anything at all. There's only workers who contributed their one day's wages. Are you doing anything at all about that? Have you done anything? But I know that to the best of my knowledge, nothing has been done. So until, or unless you come up with the, you know, antithesis thereof, I would want to know if there is anything at all that you are doing, or the organizations which you are organizing are doing anything at all. Thanks.
I will give over to Ebusa SA to respond to the questions of the members.
Chair, thank you, and honourable members. What we will do is we will take questions and respond on different questions. I will start with the easy questions. And the easiest of them all coming from Honourable Member Ellis, whether we are cozy with government. We are not cozy with government. And I think sometimes people have got expectations from business that practice in business globally doesn't relate to. It is not in the nature of business, for instance, to go out in the street and march with posters. We can do so in our individual capacities if we are part of particular structures and etc., but not as business. And this is a phenomenon that you find in many countries, and as a South African business community, I think we have chosen the route of engaging. And there can be no doubt, no question, we have a track record of achievements that our members, the South African business community, relate to. Things that we have achieved through engagement with government. When I say engagement and not being cozy, I do not mean that we don't speak publicly. We do speak publicly where we differ with government. But we also don't just accentuate our differences. We want to see what progress we can make. The announcement, for instance, yesterday by the minister on this 20 billion tax incentive, it's as a result of engagement. Various other achievements that ministers decide on policy issues, we engage continuously. There's movement between ourselves and Pretoria from Johannesburg, between business and government officials in policy-making departments. We engage. We have a lot of bilaterals. If you look at our record, for instance, in the last 18 months since this administration came into power, we've never had as many ministers at our offices as we've had in these 18 months since the advent of this democracy in 94. Not because we're cozy with the ministers, because we are able to engage and raise issues on bilateral, but also to listen where they also want to engage with us, because we also have a stake. First and foremost, before being business, we are South Africans. and we're very cognizant of our own corporate citizenship responsibilities as business. So we contribute in that. Our diversity of membership, I heard you referring to organizations such as BLSA, who, by the way, are also our members, recognize the value of the way we engage. There were headlines that the president was not talking to business and all that, which was actually not true also. Because again, you see, as business, when we have engagements on policy issues, we don't always come out and have a media brief each time to say, today we met with Minister so-and-so, these are the issues. So I do want to assure members of this committee, honorable members and members of parliament sitting here, that as business, we are not cozy. We do partner with government where there are opportunities, and we believe on what government is putting on the table, that it will achieve common objectives. We cooperate and collaborate. But where we disagree, we do state that we disagree, and we don't. We will continue to take that route of both engaging on the issues. For instance, the Consumer Protection Act, we've made a lot of inputs and engagements in shaping it, but also when the date for implementation, we engaged because we knew that the government was not ready for implementation on it. We made submissions to the minister, and he said, because of this reason and that reason, it cannot be implemented. It's impossible, because you still need to do this and that as government, and it's been postponed. So there are a lot of areas where there has been a lot of achievement through the way we engage, and we'll continue to do so, but we will never try to take your job as political parties and oppose for the sake of opposing and take a political role through you, Chair. We want to, as much as even with opposition parties, we also engage with them on issues for them to understand where we stand on policy issues and why we're raising issues in government. The issue of 5 million jobs, through you, Chair, if I said it's easy to achieve, it must have been a mistake. I do not recall saying that. I said it's achievable. We do believe as business that it is achievable. And we do believe we can achieve it. Not through the state employing. We fully concur with Honorable Member Moinamo that the state would actually be losing its responsibility and function if the state becomes an employer of choice. The state's function and responsibility is to create that environment where citizens can seize opportunities to create wealth. Actually, citizens start a business to create wealth. Jobs then become part of the package of wealth creation. And this takes individual entrepreneurs. So we do believe, I made reference to, I know as South Africa, part of the debate we often don't get right is the question of whether a cup is half full or half empty. And I think most of the time we move from a half empty perspective, and we rarely look at a half full cup. We agree that the economic growth levels that we achieved did not create sufficient jobs, but it is not true that the economic growth that we experience in this country in the years preceding the global economic crisis and the recession, that there were no jobs created. It was just growth and growth and shoulders. It's not true. I do agree with the Honorable Member Madisha that towards the end of the 90s, we were running with employment, depending on which estimation you used, which were either close to 40% unemployment or over 40% unemployment. But by the time of the recession in 2008, we were sitting with employment, depending again on which way you looked, sitting between 23.5% and 28 to 29%, which means that we had almost halved unemployment between the period 98 and 2008. So jobs were created when the economy grew, but what we are saying is that we need a new growth path that can create more jobs than we're able to create. And as I said, when we're growing the economy, when it reached 5% growth per annum, we saw this economy beginning to create 500,000 jobs per annum. And in terms of the target set by government, it's a target of about 500,000 jobs per annum, both from experience that we've had and also looking at what can be done. We strongly believe that it is achievable. It's not going to come in a platter. There are hard choices that we need to make, both from all social partners, government, labor, and business and community. We'll have to make certain hard choices in terms of what drives this economic growth path. It's not going to come easy. We would need to make certain choices about what are the sectors that are more labor absorbing. And we can see them in other countries. We would need to make choices that certain countries have made when it comes to those sectors and how we treated them. One of the sectors in this country that stands out is the automotive sector, in terms of its export capacity, but also in terms of the jobs that it has created. And there are lessons that we can also learn from what drove that sector in this country to be where it is. I've taken longer than I should have taken, and I'll allow my colleagues to respond to some of the questions, and if need be, I'll come back.
Jay, if I could just perhaps supplement.
Just explain to me, you are saying that the economic growth the past few years had an impact. Okay, let me use your words, have created jobs. There were people, it is not true, you are dismissing the fact that the members are saying the economic growth did not benefit the poor. Am I getting you right? By telling us that there were jobs that were created. So we can't therefore say that the poor did not benefit from economic growth. I'm asking that question because you know how we judge the impact of an economic growth is through changing of the living of the standards of workers. If, for instance, you go to, I don't know which area where you come from, you go to Soweto, or you go to Kukulete, or you go to Kwamashu, you make a survey of workers, I'll talk of Cape Town, who are working in textile industries for the past few years. If you talk to those workers, would they say there is a change in our lives? Because the economic growth that we talk about is economic growth that will have a direct impact on the lives of the people, because some of the jobs that are created, for instance, are not sustainable jobs.
are not permanent. Nevertheless, we count that people have benefited in terms of job, even if a person has worked for 3 months. But the bottom line is the decent work is what will have a direct impact on the lives of workers. So I think that's where we differ a bit from business, because business counts the numbers of workers that they have employed as a result of economic growth. But as politicians, in those numbers that we have employed, we want to see the difference in terms of their lives. So are you saying that there has been a change as a result of the economic growth in terms of the living standards of the poor?
Chair, what we are saying as business is that economic growth is very key to addressing poverty, to creating jobs so that people can be meaningfully engaged and change their own living environments. What I referred to, I was referring to the issue, I think that's why I use the question of half empty and half full cup. That often we say the economic growth we have experienced in this country has not created jobs. We are saying from the information that we have, it did create jobs, but the jobs that it created were not sufficient in terms of where we are coming from. And what we are searching for and what we believe in our participating at NEDLAC and in debating with government is that indeed we need to find a new growth path that is embedded in an inclusive, high growth, high job intensive, growth. So we would argue, Chair, that from the statistics that government have released, and from our own observation, is that indeed in the years that preceded 2008, when the recession broke up, we were beginning to see the economy beginning to create jobs, and that statistics confirmed that. We saw from the presidential review of the first 10 years, the last 10 years, 15 years of democracy, we've seen the were jobs that were created, but we're saying those jobs we recognize as business were not sufficient, because if they were sufficient, we wouldn't still be having the extent of unemployment as we have and poverty. So it's a level of the quantum, and we say the quantum is not sufficient. We recognize that we need to do things differently to address the quantum, and that is where, in our view, lies the opportunity going forward between ourselves, yourselves, our other social partners at NEDLAC, that as we engage on where will the jobs of the future come from, as we engage on this policy framework, we've got to look also at the learnings of the past 15 years, what worked and what didn't work. That was the point that we're raising. The issue of the living standards, again, Chair, honorable members, I alluded to the issue of labor costs. That part of the debate is really when we just look at labor costs, and if you did a survey, indeed most employees, they will give you their budget, and sometimes they end up with almost nothing at the end of the month. But not because South African business community does not pay well in comparison to other similar economies. Not because of that, but because of the economic infrastructure in our country, which we inherited before 94. There are employees that go to work every morning who get into three different modes of transport before they reach work on a daily basis. Going back home, six ultimately every day, one taxi to the train, take another taxi or a bus to the workstation. Part of our discussions going forward, when we deal with the issue of lowering the cost of doing business, if I may call that, and looking at all the input costs, we've got to deal with a whole variety of issues that says, where do we build houses for employees? Both the private sector in terms of its own programs, but also the government. We have seen in some of the areas, some of the houses that we have built, you travel out of a commercial industrial area 50 kilometers and you see a whole host of new houses coming up. There's not one industrial place there for people to be employed. As long as our planning and dealing with all the transport, public transport infrastructure becomes a key component of all that package when we're going to deal with the issue of labor costs and the cost of doing business. So overall, Chair, we are saying we're looking forward to engaging with government on this new growth path. These are some of the issues that we'll be engaging on. We do accept and agree that the economy did not create sufficient jobs as it would have had, and that's why we are working with all social partners to address that issue.
Thank you. Madam Chair, can I just follow on from that in terms of the elements around decent work, which I think both you and our colleague alluded to, and that is that the ILO talks about it as a delicate balance, because the purpose of decent work is to ensure that workers understand what their rights are, to be protected, to look after the vulnerable as well. And we certainly agree with you in terms of how their lives are changed and how we protect them from abuse. But of course the balance is to ensure that one doesn't create expectations that can't be met. As my CEO alluded to, there is the danger of expectations of wages that protect us and prevent us from being globally competitive. So decent work itself does talk to productivity, but it talks to the rights of workers as well. And one of the strategies that we've taken is not only to ensure that as social partners we actually talk to our communities and our stakeholders, but we believe that the concept of decent work and what it stands for needs to be communicated to the youth, to the casual workforce as well, so that our people start to understand what their expectations should reasonably be in terms of their working environment and the world of work as well. And it is a fine balance. And I did smile when my colleague spoke about cozy engagement, because certainly around the NEDLAC table, there was very robust debate, because we wanted to ensure that we weren't actually creating expectations that the partners could not actually deliver to. So there was a fine balance in drafting the document. I'd like to just follow on in terms of the fact that I've raised casualization, and my colleague spoke to casualization and what were we addressing in terms of business imperatives around casualization. And I guess probably listening to our social partners over the last couple of years, our strategy has changed. I think business had very much taken the stance, and I speak specifically for my sector, in terms of declaring that we were compliant and leaving it to the other social partners to address non-compliance. And we've actually taken ownership of the situation. We realize that we need to work with social partners, and part of this is an education stance, but it is also about lobbying advocacy as well, to ensure that we define what is compliant and what is not compliant, and starting to put structures in place to be able to address it. We have a public-private partnership where we're working a lot closer with government
in terms of the Labour Inspectorate, so that we're working together to ensure that we are reporting the non-compliant. But we also want to empower individuals to understand what a compliant environment is and starting to put measures in place, not just the CCMA, where they feel often that they are threatened, but starting to work with our social partners. At the moment, we have a pilot project with one of the unions to actually allow our staff members to have an ethics hotline, but a labour hotline, so that we can give advice and support behind the scenes for those non-compliant parties. And in fact, I could list a number of initiatives that are in place, but we certainly realise that we have the power to influence and support and start to address the issue of casualisation on a lot more operational perspective.
Well, Chair, if I could perhaps just add, as one of those who has the scars and the wounds of the robust engagements in NEDLAC, I would have described the relationship in many terms, but not as cozy. It's a healthy, robust debate that takes place, and hopefully, at the right time, you produce a consensus so that problems can be solved. If that's the definition of cozy, I'll live with it. That's problem solving. But it's a robust process before you get there. And it's interesting, if you look once again at the mini-budget speech, where the Minister of Finance spoke about towards a social compact, which has already, I think, been rejected by one of the social partners, that hardly suggests that there's a cozy environment. We have to work at it. It has to be negotiated, and it will be a very robust negotiation. That doesn't mean to say, as others have said, that over the past 15 years we haven't reaped some positive dividends from the social dialogue process. But I think that if we want to get to this higher job-rich growth path, we're going to have to cooperate a lot more and find more areas of agreement, or as I called it, consensual stability, around the key tough decisions which still have to be taken. If I could also perhaps make a contribution to this dilemma of our growth experience. Is growth good for jobs? Is it bad for jobs? Why hasn't it done better for jobs? I think perhaps in a way our experience is somewhat limited, because if you bear in mind, Chair and members, that indeed the Minister of Finance and others have said, look, if we really want to make a difference to job creation, we've got to grow at something like 7%. And that means that has to be supported by appropriate policies, obviously. It's not just a growth policy. Growth is not a sufficient condition for job creation, but try to create jobs without it. So it's a point of departure. And I think if we look back, Chair, if you look at global experience, where growth has been able to make a difference to job creation, you will clear up the ambiguity to some extent and resolve the dilemma if you focus on sustained growth. We have not had sustained growth. It's come in spurts. And then the lights went out. And then there was a global recession. So you in a sense, had your legs chopped off in 2008. So what is global experience? It's sustained growth at a high rate over decades, not 2 or 3 years, over decades, supported by the appropriate social and socioeconomic policies, so that you maximize the number of jobs. So what we are searching for now, I think, both with government and with labor and with business, is how do we get onto a sustained growth path? And once again, you will need a vision, whether it's 10 years or 15 years. You've got to set certain aspirational targets and then mobilize people, be it cozy or otherwise, around those targets. It's no point trying to support it with divisiveness. And I think that's the search at the moment, to find how much common ground to make a difference, do better than short spurts of growth,
and to actually move on to a much higher growth path, hence the phrase, more inclusive, more job-rich, and supported, unpacked with other supporting policies. But the important point is that the overarching goal is an economy that's moving, out of which you want to get more, not an economy that's standing still and out of which you can get less. And I think that's really where we're coming from, and hopefully our next document, which I did indicate is in the process of being finalized, will identify the tough choices that have to be made, because there are some tough choices that have to be made. And you will have to build some consensual stability around those choices to because once you have tough choices, there's some pain. And you've got to get some agreement as to how is that pain to be distributed between government, business, and labor. And that is the joint challenge that we face.
Comrade Chair, if you may allow me just quickly on the employment equity issue. I think we are concerned about, and we've been on record to our own members, we are concerned about the slow pace of transformation. We're very concerned about actually lack of transformation in some of the workplace. But like in many families, you've got good apples and bad apples. And within the business community, we do have a few bad apples that really are not doing what they should be doing. And we continue to engage publicly as well as where we pick it up. We did our own survey before the commission released its report at the JSE, and it painted the same picture. In a number of some of the companies, so we will not as BUSA condone and protect companies that are not complying with the Employment Equity Act. We've been on record saying that we need the inspectorate to be division to be strengthened in the Department of Labour. We need to see more stronger fines being imposed. That is one angle. But at the same time, we embarked on a program about 2 years ago in collaboration with the Department of Labor, where throughout the country we ran workshops to our own members to say it's important that these things do happen. And we'll continue to use both. And we think government, where there's no compliance with the law, government must utilize the law that we have all signed to. But we also recognize that there are areas where we do have challenges in certain areas of skills that cannot be obtained. And while we're conscious of the fact that we don't want those that ignore existing talent to use the lack of skills in certain areas as a blanket excuse from our own membership, we do acknowledge that we need to still continue to invest more in training. And one of the sad things, I think, in our democracy, Comrade Chair, is that in many countries or in other countries, you do tend to find that it is the top and high end skills that tend to be a challenge. But in our situation, it is the artisanship skills that we've fallen short of, and where we really need to focus. And there is an engagement. We've participated in engaging with the Ministry for Higher Education. We will continue to do so. We've encouraged our members, those that are closer to colleges of further education and training, because one of the issues also, we've had students that go into those colleges and finish the theory part but never get an opportunity to go in service in a company to be able to get their certificates and complete, and therefore they never qualify even after finishing the theory part for 3 years, 4 years without the on-the-job training. So we've been encouraging our members in industry to say work closely with colleges, but also avail yourself to be appointed in the councils of those colleges so that you can influence the curriculum. But take so we, through social dialogue, we think we'll overcome that. Chair, thank you.
Chair,
Chair, there was one point to which I wanted to respond, but I think perhaps my colleague will also do so, and that is the question about the training layoff schemes. Now, that was, we were rather proud of that originally as part of the response to the global crisis. It was what I called a big-ticket item, and we thought we'd put a lot of weight behind it. And I think there is a sense of disappointment that it hasn't worked as well as it should have. But when we unpack the reasons, there are some reasons, and maybe there's some lessons also, that when we tackle this kind of project, that we need to put some conditions in place that will heighten the chances of its success. So if I could ask my colleague to perhaps amplify on that.
Thank you. I think one of the first lessons that we realized as we unpacked the lack of success was the time frame in terms of the actual launching and implementing of the training layoff scheme. By the time it went live, over 750,000 jobs had already been lost. And these were workers who had disengaged, had left the organizations, and part of the conditions or policies around the program required that they be employees by the organization. So I guess we had lost that particular opportunity. And we specifically looked at countries such as Germany, which went to action with speed, so that they actually caught those vulnerable workers in the net very early in the process. The scheme itself was poorly marketed, not only to employers, but to employees as well. And I think disappointingly, some employers reported that employees who were offered the scheme did not actually take it up. And the assumption here is that the opportunities were not clearly presented to them, again, I guess, not understanding what the future might look, uncertainty, and we found that few of them chose or elected to get involved in the scheme. It had a lot of red tape, a lot of processes around it, which made it a long, drawn-out process, and I think when workers have been given notice of termination or retrenchment, that one wants to see speed to action, one is vulnerable, one is emotional at that particular point, and time frames of 8 to 10 weeks to get decision-making, etc., through a CCMA process, which was part of the process, became tedious for the workers, and we found they disengaged. I believe that the positive coming out of this is that we unpacked it significantly. We really wanted to look at what worked and what didn't work. There were some minor pockets of success, but certainly moving forward, as we saw it, it was a huge opportunity. We were very disappointed that it didn't work, and we worked together with the social partners. So we hope that these are lessons that we take forward should we have a similar type scheme that we need to actually take to market quickly.
Thank you. I just want to understand before I ask the question. Mr. CEO, you have agreed with the members that the employment equity is not adhered to by the companies. Are you referring to business organizations that form part of BOSA? I assume. Is my assumption right? Because the answer to that will lead me to ask a question or it may satisfy what I have in my mind. So exactly where is it the companies, business companies, that are part of this business unit in South Africa?
Chair, again, let me correct. Not all companies. I said we've got our bad apples and good apples in terms of companies. All, as the Employment Equity Commission's report indicates, but also from our own studies that we have done. In the last 2 years, we did two studies. One study, we looked at the JSE companies in terms of board appointment on gender profiling, black people, disabilities, and the picture was not that good. The second study we did was prompted by reports that were coming to us as BUSA, that in the Western Cape, there seemed to be an observable trend in a number of companies that black Africans in particular either did not rise up into senior positions in companies, and even if they did, they would either leave within a short space of time or request to be transferred within the same company to another province. We then commissioned a study to look at what were the issues that affected blacks, especially Africans, in a number of selected big companies that have got a presence in other provinces. And that report, we looked at it, it gave us a lot of very useful information also. So I was referring to companies, Chair, that we are aware that there are companies that have not complied as they should, but there are also companies that are complying but have not achieved the targets that they have set for themselves, and in certain areas because they are battling with getting the right people that are required for those positions.
Thank you so much, Mr. CEO. Now, I believe that it's charity begins at home. It can be an easy task for both to ensure that employment equity is adhered to by the companies down there. If BUSA structures, for instance, your presidents or vice presidents, four of them, there's a problem there in terms of transformation. Your boards, as a result, your chambers organization, you had one organization leaving because of similar problems of non-transforming of the chamber. Now, what is that you have in place in terms of your strategy to see to it that these chambers, including their boards, are transformed?
Chair, thank you for the opportunity. In 2007, the Black Business Presidential Working Group did a study on the state, what was then called a baseline study on black economic implementation of black economic transformation empowerment throughout corporate South in the country, because it was government, parastatals, and the private sector. That baseline report painted a very gloomy picture. The then president convened a meeting of business, labor, and government to discuss why we were where we were at the time and what we were going to do as social partners in our own respective constituencies and collectively. At the time we went back, the then president of BUSA, Mr. President, Patrice Motsepe convened a high-level council meeting specially to discuss that report. Coming out of that discussion, there were commitments that were made by our different constituencies and organizations, and that led to a signing of a pledge which was signed by the presidents of the member constituencies of BUSA, committing themselves to transformation within their own organization, but also within their membership to drive transformation in their own company membership. We've held workshops in our own constituencies. When we select people because we often nominate people for programs overseas to go for study programs, especially at the ILO Institute in Turin in Italy, we've taken a deliberate bias to ensure representativity. We bring in women, black in particular, and blacks in general, Africans in particular. Those are the numerically, if you look at our training, you would see the bias we've embarked on. But we also went on a program where we said to our members, in each of their constituencies, because some of the companies were saying, we came to BUSA as an organization because we expected it to drive transformation on the ground. But we sit together here at the level of BUSA, but when it comes to doing business on the ground, we still have our white counterparts continue to do business. And we, at that time, engaged and agreed that our members must ensure that members of SACI in Middelburg, in Leidenberg, in Uppington, talk to members of NAFCOC, that they look at joint programs, etc. So we have embarked on programs to encourage what I could call cross-fertilization across our members, and we've sought that commitment that transformation should happen at the level of our members. In terms of our own transformation, Chair, I think I can state that if you look at the office bearers of BUSA, the president is a black woman, African. There are four vice presidents. The first vice president is a colored woman. The second vice president is an African woman. The third vice president is an African male. And the fourth vice president is a white male. The CEO, I'm certain, is black. Yeah.
Is it the same thing with the board members, say, that I understand? I agree that you have tried in terms of the vice presidents, but when it comes to the boards, is it the same state or... You are trying.
So we've seen a number of our member organizations. There's progress in the transformation of our member organizations. I think from where we see it strategically, we have said we want to see that translating at company level, because it is at company level where there can be meaningful economic transformation. The survey we did with JSE companies, for instance, indicated that even where, for instance, on the gender issue, where women were appointed, we found that there were more women at board as non-executives, not as executives. And we've raised these issues that we need to get a balance. And that is the message that, as BUSA, we continue to drive.
Honorable Ellis?
Thank you, Chairperson. Noted. You answered the introduction to my question, but not
the three sub-points. It's quite a long question. And the sub-points are, what does Bootha do to engage with the educators of the country, being the Department of Education, higher education, the skills development crowd, you know, the CETAs, Skills Fund, National Skills Fund, and so on, about the fact that we are not delivering skilled employees that the country needs, and suggesting alternatives? And the second part is, what is Bootha doing to, I suppose the word is, educate the public in terms of what is realistic to expect in terms of wage increases and working condition improvements and so on? And the third one, the third part of it, is about legislation, because every bit of legislation over time, we find that there are loopholes or problems or mistakes or shortcomings that need to be addressed. Now, the department behind the scenes is working on new legislation. What is Bootha doing to engage directly with government or the Labour Department and say, well, there are things we think that should be included, lobbying government to have the law improved so that we can deliver more jobs, because some parts of legislation do hamper job growth? Those three parts of my question I don't think have been addressed almost at all directly. They've been addressed sort of indirectly at a top level, because I spoke about the word cozy. So thank you for your response, but can I have some more detail, please? Thank you, Chairperson.
Sorry, sir. Can I allow further questions from the members? Honorable Nyakemba?
Thank you very much. I think there's one part in your presentation that I think is very important to appreciate. I think it's important to appreciate that part in your presentation, where exactly you are telling us who Bootha represents. I think that's a very good part to me, because it also indicates that you are part of international bodies of employers or businesses, not only in the continent, but also internationally. That's for being a member of the International Organization of Employers. Where you represent business internationally in the International Labour Organization. Where at that level, what is discussed by social partners, in fact, that body is encouraging social dialogue. I think it's important to appreciate that, because the International Labour Organization come with conventions, and then countries who are party to the ILO need to ratify those conventions. And I think one of the key issues which the International Labour Organization want to see happening is collective bargaining. But if you look at the South African experience, I think we might be more advanced than other countries in relation to that. So I'm saying, what you indicated earlier as to your approach or attitude in the engagement at NEDLAC, because NEDLAC came as is an act of parliament, so which brings social partners something that was not there before, that trade unions and employers and government, we cannot sit in our corners and shout at each other. Instead, we must create a forum where we are going to engage in order to reach consensus. And I think that is important. And I'm appreciating that, and I think you need to continue and making sure that that dialogue, social dialogue, takes place and is represented. I'm raising this. I'm not sure whether it was you, Mr. Parsons. Before 1999, I think Honorable Shilowa, he was still the General Secretary of COSAG at that time. There was a tour, an international tour, between business and trade unions. So I think there are positive things that have happened. So I'm trying to appreciate that. It's important to appreciate that. The on the issue of looking at youth, how do you bring them? Whether through employment or through businesses, them establishing businesses, what is your relationship with the National Youth Development Agency? I didn't hear you saying anything on that, but I assume you did raise that one of the focuses of your organization is to make sure how do you take the youth on board. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Moinamo.
Thank you, Chairperson. I asked a specific question. My question wanted to know if BUSA has actually done a skills audit in order to come to a point when you can say, in this country, these are the skills that we have and they are enough. And these are the skills that we are really in need of. We don't have these skills. Simply, when the stadiums were built in this country for the World Cup, it was discovered that South Africa has very little, a few people who are well trained on a simple thing such as welding. And for that matter, the country has had to import people to come and do welding at these stadiums. And we want to know. We don't want people to speak broadly about the skills. We must specify so that we know which skills we don't have in this country. And secondly, as business, you are actually partners in reshaping the education system of this country. And I also ask questions to say, if we're looking at halving the skills gap in this country by 50%, what contribution is BUSA coming up with to say we are doing this in order to meet the government halfway in reducing the skills gap in this country? And that question was not answered. I actually indicated that this is difficult because the majority of our learners are attending schools that are not functional, that don't have facilities. And perhaps lastly, is BUSA holding that the government has created the environment conducive enough for business investment? Thanks.
Honorable Nkonyane.
Chair, honorable members and the leadership of BUSA, good morning. My apologies, the royalty is never late. It can only be delayed. And my apologies for having been delayed. First of all, I must also, Chair, through you, raise my voice to appreciate the presentation. And in appreciating the presentation, actually also I'm saying I am aware of their slogan. I don't know what is the slogan, One Voice of Business. And no doubt, I'm sure you want to unify all the members of the business community under this progressive movement.
I can only wish you all success in that regard. But my question, first question, Chair, is the question of recession. We are aware that there's been economic recession, economic meltdown, all these things, particularly in the recent past. And I have not read in this presentation, I didn't hear in the response to the question from my colleague, the strategy of BUSA, what role, if any, has it played in trying to mitigate against, of course, damage inflicted by such things. Secondly, Chair, it's gratifying to note, and I think it's paragraph 0.9 of anti-poverty, there are 9 pillars. Talking about the strategic intervention of BUSA to promote, to be involved, of course, to promote poverty reduction, and saying over coming months, which will include what is close to my heart on rural development, food security, SMEs, and energy projects, etc. But I don't see anything that in the coming months by when. I see the principle of dealing with this matter in the coming months. Is it 2 months? 3 months? How many months? An indication I would really appreciate, Chair. The other is on job growth. Similar, Chair. I think it was on point number 8 and 9 on the job growth, the choices. The first is use bold measures to reach 50% of the unemployment. Again, here, by when? I'm not so sure. Then the next one, the very next one, increase the percentage of school leaving youth accessing job market to 75. These are very, very good. But again, tell me by when, what is the strategy really to reach that target? If they could share with the committee, I would appreciate, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Sokwe.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, as a rural resident, you would want to appreciate the difficulty I'm facing to express myself on this presentation, because, you see, business being business by virtue of being business, it can't exist without making profit. There'll be no sense for business to exist. You can't make profit. I mean, I've been quiet for some time in this meeting trying to get the right tool to say what I want to say as a rural person. Somebody who is placed in the far remote area, far away from the centers, with no infrastructure at all. I begin to wonder, because, you see, I was encouraged one time when somebody from business saying, you can't imagine yourself as business investing in a rural area, because it's too expensive. It's just too expensive. And it's too risky. So I'm beginning to wonder as to whether, as a person from a far removed area, whether I'm in the right meeting today, because I don't hear you saying anything as to in engagement with government, which is encouraging to engage in any way. That's a African way of doing things, through dialogue, engaging to find each other about priorities with regard to development. Where do you see yourself? Where do you locate yourself in terms of as my colleague here, Khoshi, has indicated, in terms of rural development, job creation in the Far Remote area. I wonder whether I'm making sense, because business can't make profit in those areas, so there will be no sense to invest at all. So in this case, for me, I would prefer a more stronger government to level the playing field in terms of building infrastructure. But for business, because they can make profit very quickly, it will make no sense.
Thank you, Member. Honorable Matisse?
No, thanks, Chair. Won't waste your time. In my opinion, the report is good. But again, in my opinion, does not indicate the implementation of what may be good objectives. I therefore would propose that this particular objective should be rather implemented as a matter of urgency. And we therefore need to come up with a period within which all this will see implementation. And perhaps your good authority will be able to say, Chair, that from this to that time, can we come together and assess the implementation? Secondly, there are, of course, very many sitters in the country. And one will rise with authority and say that they are not realizing what they were, what they are supposed to implement. Now, to therefore say that what then becomes your role in ensuring that we ensure implementation. Of course, if you talk about skills development, you cannot do that yourself somewhere without involving the greatest majority of the role players in the country. To therefore say this is going to be the strategy, and of course we may not come up with that yet. Can one therefore propose that you go sit down and say this is what is going to be followed, done, to ensure that the role players within those particular theaters is looked into, we're able to move forward together. The other point is, you talk here about SMMEs, the growth. One would say it's not really what is happening. If indeed it is happening, it's only a few who have access to that implementation. And we therefore have got to talk. I mean, my comrade, Comrade Kloakwe here, he and I, Chair, have operated in the same rural areas at some stage. I understand what he's talking about. To therefore say that the SMMEs, really, the growth is not sustainable in very many of them. Can we therefore talk about that? It may not be here again, because people may not have prepared when they came here. To therefore say, this is going to be the program moving forward, and they therefore have got to come back and report to us to say within this period, yes, something has been done. So far as NACLEC, because the cited DHA is concerned, we know that there are problems. When some of us played a role in the trade union movement, Prof, I know that we came together from time to time there, and in the earlier protested that the government then, and I'm told still that is still the case, has not been playing a role properly. Ministers, of course, were not coming, and one is informed that you still have that particular problem in that particular area. To therefore say, what is it that we believe has got to be done to make sure that there is implementation? And lastly, Chair, one raised this point about the contribution of business. I will not put pressure on you to respond now, because I realize that it may not be feasible because the role has not been played. For you to meet with the Job Creation Trust, workers gave that trust 89 million rand. I know that that trust has, you know, evolved the you know, a number of strategies It has gone on to come up with financial statements for the past 10 years. And one has not seen at all, because we played a particular role, has not seen at all the implementation, the actual play from the side of business, insofar as that whole thing is concerned. To therefore say, can we meet with them so that there is implementation and we see the creation of jobs in the country? Thanks, Chair. That was the last
thing. I will allow a break for 7 minutes. Just 7 minutes, and then we can come back. 7 minutes.
Thank you. No, I think we know he's decided against that task. Well, we're actually still looking, but we just think it's going to cost too much for us to whatever that other day. But yeah, but thanks, Stephen. Okay, have a good day. Thanks, bye.
Now, you can answer your questions. It's time for you to respond to these additional questions.
Comrade Chair, honorable members, thank you, and thanks for the positive comments and feedback. We really appreciate that. Let me respond to the issue of education. What is WUSA doing in terms of education? Obviously, we have a stake in the matter, but it's not our entire mission. But we have a serious stake, a vested interest. In the last year, we have met twice with the HESA, the Higher Education South Africa body that represents the chancellors of universities and technicons. The reason why we started engaging with them, we felt that there's a problem in the country where at any given time, reports say the country is not able to fill 250, at some stage, the Human Science Research Council published statistics, and we had over 200,000 jobs that could not be filled over a period of time because the skills were not available. But at the same time, we had literally hundreds of thousands of unemployed graduates. And part of the message that has been coming from our members, from our constituencies, has been that there tends to be a mismatch between what the universities produce and what industry needs. And the discussion we've been engaging on is how do you ensure that what the universities produce is aligned to the needs of industries. And we're having these sessions and through dialogue to understand and for them to also appreciate what the thinking of business is to input into that. The second process, I indicated that we started a campaign a few years ago wherein we've been encouraging our members to serve in councils. And we've engaged with the minister, even the new minister when he was appointed, we met with him. And we said, do approach us when you need to appoint council members at universities, but speak to the university councils when they've got vacancies. We're encouraging our members to sit in there so that they can influence policy implementation curriculum at the universities. The third issue, we have the HRD Council that has just been set up and chaired by the Deputy President of the country. We have in that representatives that we've nominated from companies that we felt have set up a trend and a record on skills development and training, and we said we asked those senior executives in those companies to sit in and nominated them to government to sit as in that council representing BUSA business in its entirety in South Africa and inputting in the processes. We anticipate that the HRD Council led by the Deputy President is a key instrument in terms of meeting the question that was raised, I think, by Honorable Member Moinamo on skills audit and what the skills needs of the country is. That is the council that must be able to say these are the key priority skills areas for this country. One of the reasons, among others, why although as business initially we're very critical of a national planning commission, but when we finally assessed issues, one of the reasons why we welcomed the National Planning Commission, it's because we saw it as an opportunity to fill a gap that has been missing in the country since 1994, wherein as a country we can define an end state at a particular year, whether it's 2025 or 2040 or 2050, and we have seen many countries, emerging economies, that have done and come up with a roadmap that says, where do we want to be as a country in 2050 or in 2025, as our National Planning Commission is planning. And we anticipate that as business, that will help in, for instance, saying, and in our own discussion on the new growth path, that the document that we are preparing as business, what we have done, we are asking those questions that says, what are the kind of skills that this economy will need? For instance, government's document last on the new growth path says so many jobs will come from renewable energy. It's a completely new industry in this country, and we need to identify what are those kind of skills and where are they going to come from, and what are the technologies that will drive those skills. So we will make our input through the HRD Council. We do make inputs into CITAS, as we would know that in terms of the legislation, we sit at CITA governing bodies together with our colleagues from Labour, and we influence decisions in the CITAS, and indeed the CITAS companies pay a minimum of 2% levy towards skills development. I'm saying a minimum because we are aware of some in our constituencies in the business community who are spending far above the 2% in terms of skills development, in the money that in addition they spend in their own companies to promote skills development. Honorable Member Madisha spoke about the question of what we have done. The business trust, which was funded by business and has been key in funding a number of projects, including the research that was done and the setting up of the process of how South Africa could position itself globally on the business process outsourcing industry internationally. The business trust played a key role there. We are aware that currently there's a balance in the business trust because the business community raised over $1 billion that went into the business trust. At the moment, it's sitting with a balance of just over $100 million that is still unspent from the money that came into the business trust in response to that call which was made by President Mandela at the time. So, yes, business will continue to play its part, but government must lead.
Just as a final point in terms of government's role in leadership, is one of the key initiatives that we would like to see come out, and we're hoping through the HRD, is an integrated process. Currently, we're one of the few countries in the world where we don't have an accurate view of the job vacancies that exist at any one time. We don't have accurate labour market stats, which certainly in the short term would be able to give us an informed view of job vacancies and where we could actually accelerate development to move into those immediate vacancies and perhaps remove the need to rely on work permits and foreign labour in our marketplace. And we know that the development for the last 8 years has existed with Department of Labour in terms of the ESSA system, but really we welcome seeing it go live so that we have a collective view.
Chair, if I could respond to some of the questions that were raised. The first is, in regard to wage increases, I think the big issue here is, of course, productivity. And one only gets alarmed if there's a perception that wage increases or salary increases have greatly exceeded productivity.
Certainly Bhutha has expressed its view on this matter more than once by saying that there certainly has to be a very strong link, especially in the future if we are looking for a higher growth path between wage increases and productivity. And here, the work of Productivity South Africa, for example, is really quite important, and maybe issue of productivity should not be a Cinderella of the big economic debate that is taking place. And certainly we in BUSA will be emphasizing that quite a lot as we engage and as our documentation will emerge. The second issue is in regard to the engagement with the Department of Labor. Well, of course, as you know, in terms of the NEDLAC Act, any change to the labor law or regulation has to go to NEDLAC. And so apart from the engagement in NEDLAC, we also engage bilaterally with the department. But what we try to urge upon government, that instead of doing this on an ad hoc basis, every time you have a sort of early warning that there's going to be some kind of amendment and then you have to address it, is that we've encouraged government, and there's progress being made here, in the implementation of a regulatory impact assessment mechanism. And this is now starting to be applied, including in the Department of Labor. And this systematizes your evaluation and also then enables business to make a more structured input to a formal process of evaluation on that basis. So we certainly intend to develop that as BUSA and to encourage that mechanism to be used more widely, particularly as we search for a higher growth path and we realize that smart, you know, as the phrase is, smart tape is better than red tape. So part of that search is through the RIA mechanism. The other issue which I'd like to just also refer to, I think one of the members raised the issue of the investment environment. I think this is key. That's a major thrust of the search for the higher growth path and indeed more jobs, is to enlarge and improve our investment climate, to attract more foreign direct investment rather than the kind of investment that we are getting at the moment, which is strengthening the rand. And we certainly think that the current ratio, it's roughly 20% of GDP, which we are currently devoting to investment. The fact remains that if we want to grow at 5, 6, and 7%, that's got to rise to 25 or indeed 27% of GDP. So that's a challenge that we face. And since our level of domestic savings is low, we'll have to ensure that we do become a preferred investment destination from a global point of view. So that, I think that's a very important point and will form a very important part of the contribution that BUSA will make to the debate around a higher growth path. On the issue of the global crisis, I think I should just place on record that there was, of course, the collective document which was released on the 19th of February of 2009, which was signed off by government, labor, business, and the community on how to deal with the crisis. In fact, South Africa has been applauded by the ILO and others for actually being in the forefront of initiatives to cushion as far as possible the impact of the recession on the South African economy. And we have, of course, followed up some of those measures. But more broadly speaking, we've been very supportive and have advocated, indeed, that we should be pursuing a counter-cyclical policy, of which you saw evidence in the budget in February, and you saw more evidence of that in the so-called mini-budget of last week. We've supported and advocated that that is the strategy for us to follow. Also, the complementary support from monetary policy, that as inflation has declined and as we've tried to get out of the recession, we have supported and advocate a steady reduction in the level of interest rates. The final point, Chair, which I'd like to respond to, is the very important point also raised about the capacity of NEDLAC and its constituents to monitor the decisions that are taken and to do its work. I think there's a feeling on the part of all the participants that the capacity of NEDAC does need to be strengthened, particularly in the light of the new challenges that are being given to social dialogue. And here in particular, I mean, to be practical, I haven't got the figures with me, unfortunately, but if you compare the funding of NEDLAC compared with other statutory bodies, I think it would be fair to say that if you saw it as an inverted sort of pyramid with a very narrow base of 16 or 17 million rand supporting this huge social dialogue challenge, there's something out of balance there. And we certainly need to look at the capacity of NEDLAC and its funding so that it can play the stronger and more enhanced role that is expected of it in responding to the challenge of a higher growth path and all the things that have to come with it.
Yes, Chair, sorry members, I'm here behind the pillar. Some of the members started to ask questions around the choices around our jobs growth section. And I just wanted to point out that those choices are really illustrative. They are quite aspirational, as you might have seen, but it was really to stimulate debate on our jobs growth document that we are in the process of putting together. The document, as Professor Parsons have noted, will most probably see light of day in the next couple of weeks. And once we do release it, I think we will take it on as the parliamentary office to make sure that members get it in their pigeonholes at parliament. So as far as those particular points are concerned, they're not cast in stone. That was to stimulate our own thinking. More practical suggestions will be coming forth in our document. Thanks.
Comrade Chair, I just wanted to respond to Honourable Member Tokwe's question on rural development. I heard this story, Chair, through you, of a man who was sent by a company from Europe and went to a certain country in our continent to explore setting up a factory for shoes. And he arrived, he spent some days, and then he got into the boat and went back and told them, forget about opening a factory for shoes. No one wears shoes in that country. The people were walking around without shoes. Later on, another company sent somebody to the same country to explore. The man said, send so many people, all the people don't have shoes here. Huge market for us. And took a different position. I think, Chair, the issue of rural development, it's a huge opportunity in our country. It's a huge opportunity for business. Business can make huge profits in our rural areas. But again, it depends on how we approach it. And part of our discussions with the Minister for Rural Development in the meetings we've had, and also in the meeting with the President on the 13th of July this year with BUSA leading 40 captains of industry, and the President that specifically prioritized the issue of rural development in that discussion. Government, and I think it comes to the role, Chair, of what is the role of a developmental state? A developmental state that is confronted with a reality where you have in one country, two countries. One, in terms of its development, compares with the best of developed countries' economies, and another one, which is a completely underdeveloped and undeveloped country by all standards, which is primarily where the rural communities are. I think in government determines where business goes in most instances by creating the environment. If government says there is a community out there, there's a need for a road infrastructure. No company in construction will say, I'm not going to bid to build a road. I'm not going to go there because it's rural. If government says there's a need for bridges because children don't go to school when it's raining because there are rivers, and there's an opportunity to build a bridge there, business will go there. If government says we're going to develop a housing infrastructure in that area, both local construction companies and other companies from elsewhere will go. I think the development of the rural communities lie in the broader strategic choices and decisions government will make in discussions with business and other social partners. We know, for instance, that many of the communities do not have access to banks in rural areas, but we also know that it is in those areas where a number of people are also receiving social grants that are paid by the state. Others are working elsewhere. Others want to work in the mines, want to send money and to their families and all that. Again, it's creating the environment. So we have started already discussing these issues. We are engaging, and we are pleased that the new growth path also emphasizes agriculture, because that is where the opportunities are also in the rural areas. But we believe government must take a lead, and as the private sector will work side by side with government. The reality, Chair, in concluding on this issue, is that in many instances, things happen because government has either created the policy instrument that enables investors to go in there. That's why we've seen in other countries where in a desert, suddenly you have growing a first-class, world-class economic hub because there's a policy decision to do so. And then an environment to attract investors is created, and investors will come in. Rural development, I think business will be there as soon as the right policy instruments to incentivize and attract business to go there are in place.
Thank you, members, and thank you, Busa. We have come to the end of the meeting. I just want to comment on what my colleague has said, that the relationship between government, labor, and business is cozy, but you did answer that question in a very strategic way, because I like what you are saying, that the business and government should work side by side. And in this case, as we speak, the government is the biggest client of BUSA. Your advertising agencies that are huge, they fall under BUSA. Your NAMSA, where government buys lots of cars, placement agencies, they fall under BUSA. So, and the trade unions, the workforce that is used by BUSA, it comes from the labor movement. And it shows that all these three cannot survive without each other. They all have to live side by side. No one should be pointing fingers, but we should negotiate for a better outcome. I just want to again salute BUSA. BUSA is a result of a democratic changes that were ushered in our country in 1994. It's not an organization that just came out. We salute them for being a melting pot of the business in South Africa. irrespective of color or ideological affiliation. And the strides or the changes, the efforts that we have made in putting these businesses together and trying to transform, it's well appreciated. Transformation is not an easy road. Even us in parliament or in government, we have not mastered it 100%. But it does not stop us from asking your strategies and your plans in order to achieve the final goal. But we just want to say thank you so much. When we ask, we don't ask because we want to corner you or we don't love you. You have to exist without you. There'll be no country. There has to be business. But we want to understand. You are unlike the Department of Labor. We can't just call you and say, come tomorrow, we want to talk to you. You have your own commitments. So thank you so much for coming. And please convey our message to the President that we have accepted the apology. We understand the conditions under which the led her not to be part of the committee today. Thank you so much. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.